There are demons among us. The devil has released them for the final battle. It's being fought right now. But nobody knows it except us and others like us.
I'm scared, Dad.
There's nothing to be afraid of, Tiger. We've been chosen by God. He will protect us. He's given us special jobs to do. We don't fear these demons. We destroy them. We pick them up one by one and we pitch them out of this world.
I think this guy's a couple cans short of a six-pack.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartleball. I'm joined with Chris Durham.
Hey, guys.
This is our 10th episode.
I got my tuxedo on, as you can tell.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, most people celebrate their 100th episode. We're on our 10th. Between this and Pop Culture Ninja, we've done close to 50 episodes. And this, we're kind of getting into a groove. And we've got a lot of cool stuff, I think, planned for the podcast coming up. We also have a website that's about to drop. It's going to be fangalaxy.com that you'll be able to go to. We're going to have reviews and things like that. And both podcasts will be available there, both Phantom Galaxy and Pop Culture Ninja. Tonight, we have a lot of different things we're going to talk about. Tonight's going to be a little bit more of a review episode where we're going to catch up on some of the things. One of the big reviews we have for you tonight is Logan, the new Marvel movie.
Woo-hoo!
And which Chris and I, we both got to see a couple weeks ago, actually. And we've got some other mini reviews. We have some news that we'd like to talk about. We're also going to, but before we do all that, really going to start out with, I guess, something that's kind of a little bit downbeat, which is that as of recording this, we are a day out from actor Bill Paxton passing away at 61, which is it's just really a shame. He's really young. And it's funny because not too long ago, about a week and a half ago, my wife and I were watching television and there was a preview for Training Day, the TV show, which I didn't realize was a thing. And they've kind of swapped the races because in the original Training Day film, it was Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke. And in this one, it looks like Bill Paxton is playing sort of the corrupt, wild police officer. So
the man you knew he really was in real life.
So in watching that trailer, I had no real interest in the show except to say, hey, Bill Paxton's in this. I think I'd actually watch it. So I'd give it a shot. And so it was really sad to hear that he passed on. Because for me, Bill Paxton is the kind of guy who, not necessarily an actor that you think of and you think, oh, this is automatically going to be a great movie. He's going to be able to conform directly to this character. Not a character actor, but a guy who always brought a sense of fun and kind of a sense of something interesting to most of the movies he was in. A guy who, every time I'd see him in a movie, I would smile and be happy that he was there. And I think, particularly in genre terms, he's done a lot of stuff. He's done a lot of good stuff.
Tons.
And he was a pretty integral part of some good stuff. And I was there's a certain aspect of his career that I think had even more potential than the acting, which is he had a couple stints in directing. And one of the movies he directed was the movie Frailty.
The
movie from 2001, 2002, a horror film that was not really your typical horror movie.
No,
really
that one was kind of nutty. Yeah,
yeah, it was strange, and it didn't even it kind of dovetailed genres. You know, I think you've referred to it many times as a dark drama more than a horror film, kind of a
dark
southern
family drama,
a southern gothic kind of movie with a lot of weird religious overtones. But again, passed away due to complications with heart surgery. So sad to lose Bill, but wanted to take some time just to kind of talk about him and his films a little bit because I think he did bring a lot to, particularly, the genre films. He stands out. He has characters that stand out to me in a lot of big movies. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought he was one of the great like supporting actors, really filling that role for a lot of movies. You know, he's when you think aliens, you have iconically instantly you think to yourself, game over, man, game over.
Which
you know,
I'm sad to say is the words that came to my head when
exactly.
I saw the thing that he had passed away.
Not even being flippant, it's just something that you're like,
yes.
You think that, and it's like, oh, it's so true, sad. Yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed his the work that he's done, obviously, as a genre fan. He's been in so many things. I was looking at his filmography, he looked like he had like 93 credits to his name.
A lot more.
And
I
at
think
61, that's pretty impressive.
And some of that, I mean, I think a lot of people haven't maybe seen him in a lot in recent years, but he had Big Love, which ran for several years and was a pretty successful show.
Yeah.
I never really saw much of it. I think it was on Showtime or something. But, I mean, he did have that long-running show. And in more recent years, he had some guest appearances on TV shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. In Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., he had... I remember I actually kind of started re-watching the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because Bill Paxton had entered his story. He kind of got hooked up with Cameron pretty early on. Yeah. And it's funny because...
He did.
We were discussing how the internet's such a wonderful place that the minute Paxton passes away... Only hours later do you have people pointing out, well, he was the only actor to ever be killed by a Terminator, a Predator, and the Xenomorph from Aliens. And of course, because because it's the internet, it can't stop there. Someone has to say, well, no, what about Lance Henriksen, who was killed by the same amount of creatures? And of course, because it's the internet, it can't stop there. And
no.
So then they have to point out, we never saw Paxton actually die in Terminator, and wasn't Lance Henriksen's android character, Bishop, technically not alive to begin with. And then
not technically dead.
Not technically dead, you know, when he dies later. Spoilers for the Alien franchise. It's not at the hands of a Xenomorph. So I think it's probably safe to say that given that both of these guys were in proximity enough to be killed by an alien, a Predator, and a Xenomorph is impressive enough.
Yeah.
But certainly... You know, he was a fan favorite in a lot of those movies. And he was a favorite of James Cameron because, I mean, early on he's in Terminator. And I think he was originally a set designer on a lot of different movies, including a really bad Alien ripoff called, like, Galaxy of Terror from, like, the early 80s. So have I. I'm not proud of it. And Cameron... came up through the same channels. Of course, he did Piranha 2 with, like, Roger Corman.
Now that's a masterpiece.
It's something. And then they get to Terminator, and of course Bill Paxton shows up as the sort of the leader of the three punks in that opening scene where they confront Arnold, kind of a classic scene, and he's there. And he goes on to play Hudson, like you said, in Aliens. And that is kind of what was fun about that character is he's the kind of character that is almost comic relief. But he doesn't play him, really. He plays him as smarmy, kind of marine that you'd expect. And the big twist of Aliens, of course, is the Marines go in there and they're getting ready to clean up. And then they're just decimated. And everyone reacts in different ways. And Hudson just breaks down. And he's screaming and running and saying, you know, why don't you put her in charge? And just crazy stuff. But it's a kind of, in its own way, it is kind of a good performance. Because he keeps it in the realm of he's a hysterical soldier who's out of his depth, but he isn't just comic relief, and he doesn't become the bad guy. You know, he kind of gets a chance to pull it together. He feels realistic in the context without just being silliness, but at the same time he lightens up some of those really dark scenes, you know, like in a way that's interesting. I actually liked him a lot more in Near Dark, which was Kathryn Bigelow, who director of Hurt Locker was married to Cameron. They were kind of making action movies in the same kind of time frame. She later went on and did Point Break. Have you seen Near Dark?
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah, he's almost a complete 180 in Near Dark, because he's a really sadistic vampire.
If you're a younger person who loves vampire movies, you definitely need to check out Near Dark.
If you're any kind of person, really. Well,
yeah, I just meant like someone who's like not seen it yet. I assume most of the genre fans
you're
that
true.
Are older.
Like, yeah. If Near Dark is a title that doesn't strike you, you know, Fright Night maybe, or you know The Lost Boys, I don't feel like Near Dark gets the same play. I think it's a better movie than Lost Boys. I have a really soft spot in my heart for Fright Night, but they're probably equal. Yeah. They're both really good. And Near Dark is kind of like we've spoken about before, it's kind of a neo-Western. Mm-hmm. Lance Henriksen is there too.
Yes.
And Jeanette Goldstein. So it was like almost half the cast of Alien came over for that. But he stood out to me in that movie. I remember him licking the blood off his fingers.
Yeah.
And it's a thing where there's comedy relief, but he's also the scary kind of villain of the movie. So he did Near Dark. He had Aliens. He's in a small sci-fi movie I haven't seen in years that I remember. It's not a very well-known one, called Slipstream. Did you ever see that, Chris?
Never did.
It's definitely a small movie. I think it was probably back in that time period. It might have been a direct-to-video kind of deal, VHS. It was 1989. It's got a pretty impressive smaller cast of actors, though. I mean, or people that you, in a sci-fi genre now, we would be interested in, although at the time it wouldn't have meant much. Mark Hamill is kind of coming just a few years off of Star Wars, and he's not the main character, but he's a bounty hunter. It's a future world that has has elements of Blade Runner and things like that, where bounty hunter chasing an android character who's played by Bob Peck. Bob Peck might not come to mind as an actor you know of, but most likely you do. Bob Peck was in Jurassic Park. He was the character, the Muldoon character, who was the head of the Raptors. Clever girl.
Clever girl.
Him, exactly. Yeah. So he plays the android. Bill Paxton is the kind of human character that they kind of form a bond and go on the run from Mark Hamill and some of the other hunters. So
that sounds interesting.
It's not a great movie. I really am interested in rewatching it because it's a movie I primarily have memories of seeing when I was younger and enamored with movies like Aliens and things like that. So Slipstream, an interesting movie. My memory of it is it was interesting. It was definitely low budget. As we talked about him, you know, the trifecta there. He was in Predator 2.
Ooh, and now that's the best of the series, clearly.
Well, you know, though, do you remember Predator 2?
I do. Actually, I remember watching it not too long ago. I mean, like, I remembered it much more fondly than it actually deserves, I think.
That's probably true. I haven't seen it in a long time. The director, Stephen Hopkins, he also directed the Lost in Space remake, so he's not quite on the same caliber as John McTiernan, who did the original. Mm-hmm. He did also that movie, The Ghost in the Darkness, with the lions, which I kind of have a soft spot for.
I like the idea behind Predator 2. I thought it was interesting, and I liked how it started off with like them hunting down like the Colombian drug lords and stuff. That whole sequence was crazy.
My memory but is it's it was not fun, that good. But you're saying it doesn't hold up. So
no,
much.
Not so
I
much.
I did
for
like
me.
Paxton's character though, and yeah. I kind of like. I also remember that Morton Downey Jr. was in there, kind of doing his thing. But Danny Glover, of course, was an interesting choice coming off of that. But that scene, there's a scene in the, I believe I could be off, the subway where Paxton has to confront the Predator, which is a pretty cool.
That was a neat
scene.
Little scene. Yeah.
There were things I liked about Predator 2. It's interesting because I will probably want to go back and rewatch it. I know we have another Predator movie coming our way. So
oh my,
yeah, exactly. Well, after Predators, I have hope maybe this will get it right, but we'll see. There's a really bizarro, kind of trashy B movie. B may even be
lay it on us. I like the sound of it already.
It's called The Dark Backward with Judd Nelson.
Wow, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, there's some crazy scenes in this. There's particularly Bill Paxton's character is a really creepy, skeevy, morally bankrupt garbage man. There's one point where I believe, if my memory serves, he's sort of making out with a dead corpse he finds in the trash.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's a mess. And he encourages his friend, who's Judd Nelson, to kind of become this stand-up comedian who's pretty terrible at it. But I think maybe because of being proximity to the junkyard, he ends up growing a third arm out of his back.
What?
To try to use this as a sort of gimmick to become an effective
comedic prop.
You have that thing for those edgy off the wall comedians, so maybe yes. The Dark Backwards
that might work for me.
I don't have enough memory of it to say it was good. I just remember it being
that's crazy
bizarre. There's a movie that I've committed to finding and watching and reviewing on this podcast, which
really?
Is called The Vagrant.
What?
And Bill Paxton is the main character in here. The poster. Even the IMDb like listing says something along the lines of, you know, a young guy with his life together buys a house and then must contend with the previous occupant who's still there, a dirty bum. I mean, they straight up refer to him as a dirty bum.
That is awesome.
So the cover has Paxton with his hands on his face like Home Alone.
No way.
And the silhouette of the hobo in the background. And I think there's even a tagline like he's not home alone. So,
oh my goodness! This sounds awesome.
So he's done a lot of stuff. He was the used car salesman in True Lies, which I always was a funny kind of scene.
He plays
a scene with Schwarzenegger that's pretty hilarious when Schwarzenegger finally like kind of confronts him because he's trying to seduce Schwarzenegger's wife, who was Jamie Lee Curtis in the movie. Of course, Apollo 13 was probably a movie where a lot of people who didn't know about Paxton earlier. Got to see him do a little bit more drama.
Serious work.
You know, yeah, exactly. And Apollo 13, really good movie, a really nice like cast, and he got to be a part of that. Another weirdo movie. I think most people will probably also know him for Twister, which is kind of the big...
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I have not much to say. I mean, I don't remember much about it, to be honest. He was kind of lead with Helen Hunt, and it kind of was what it was.
I feel like it might be interesting to go back and review that one and kind of compare its special effects of the day to now. Because that was supposed to be like the greatest special effects when it came out.
I remember them being enjoyable. I feel like they would look like a screensaver maybe now. You know, I mean, that's a movie where Jurassic Park's dinosaurs still help do Twister's tornadoes hold up? That might be an episode talking about the evolution of special effects. If we could find an interesting angle, like, that could be fun.
Yeah.
It's hard, I think, when you don't have the special effects to look at, but maybe that's our YouTube episode. He was in a little movie, I don't know if you ever saw, called The Last Supper. It also has your boy Ron Perlman in it.
No.
So this is a...
The Last Supper was that Alien Covenant prequel we saw last time.
Yeah, well, this was a movie where Bill Paxton, among others, there are a bunch of, like, kind of neurotic liberal types who, at one point, end up inviting a pretty caustic, conservative, Republican political figure to their house. Mm-hmm. And accidentally killing him.
What?
And then they realize this isn't such a bad idea.
No way.
And so they start to do this as a way to rid the world of the people that they just don't think should be in it anymore.
Wow.
So
that's nutty.
That's another one it would be probably good to return to. I remember being not impressed, more like baffled a little bit by it, but I wonder in our today's climate where I think things have just become even more polarized. Yeah. How a movie like The Last Supper plays. Because Last Supper was satirizing that kind of polarization. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're unfortunately further down that road.
Yes.
On every side of the fence.
It brings White House Correspondents' Dinner a whole new meaning.
Right. He was the lead in a I thought, a relatively fun remake of Mighty Joe Young, mm-hmm. movie from mm-hmm. the 90s that Disney did in the late 90s. Rob Underwood, the director of Tremors, did that one. He's in a movie I really, really like, Sam Raimi's A Simple Plan. Did you ever see that?
Nope.
It's really good. He was in it, Billy Bob Thornton was in it, Bridget Fonda. It's one of those movies that where the villain or the monster of the piece is a big bag of money and human greed. but a really had a really weird, cold, creepy sort of setting and a lot of kind of watching normal people sort of come unraveled. And it mm-hmm. was Raimi in a very reserved kind of mode. So I'd strongly recommend it. I thought it was an excellent movie. The year it came out in 98, it was probably top tier. And Paxton, this is another movie, he gives a really good performance. He's giving an actual performance that feels like a real person. Mm-hmm. And in a scenario that gets increasingly weird and out there and kind of grounds it.
Sounds interesting.
Do you remember when he was the kind of Jimmy Buffett wannabe? You may have never seen this movie. Broken Lizard did Club Dread.
I did see that, yeah.
Do you remember that? He had the dreadlocks. It was
ridiculous, yeah.
Not a good movie. No. What were the other movies? He did Super Troopers and the Slammin' Salmon or something like that.
It was ridiculous.
I don't think any of his movies were good, but they have moments that have a special place in my
I think if you're going to watch any of them, this one is probably...
Club Dread was... I had some laughs. More entertaining.
Yeah, I got some laughs out of it.
It was funnier than any of the scary movies.
Yes.
I guess that's not really
that's
the
not
highest
hard to do, I guess.
Class, but
although Anna Faris still has a place in my heart.
Yeah.
Moving on.
And then, like, Frailty, again, he both directed and starred in that
now, movie. That movie I have seen. There's a lot of movies on that list I have not seen. I did see Frailty, and I liked it a lot. I didn't feel it was super horror-y.
It's a very specific kind of horror movie that I don't think in 2002 people, and even now, people weren't making a lot of.
Yeah.
It would have been at home more in the 1940s even, I think, in its style, like almost Val Lewton style, or Night of the Hunter, you know.
Night of the Hunter, yes.
That has that weird view of childhood, of a horror story viewed through the eyes of children, even though it's not a children's film. Mm-hmm. Frailty kind of had that, where you had a child's mm-hmm. perspective of something really horrible and monstrous happening. And so... I agree, but there's a lot of almost expressionistic scenes in there. There's the plot. We're not going to review the movie, but Paxton, he's directing it, but he's also starring in it, and he plays this father who wakes up one day and tells his kids that God's given him a list of people to kill, and these people are really demons.
Yes, and he has like holy weapons they have to find to use for this task.
And right, and he's stuff. But he doesn't play it in a way where Dad becomes a bad guy per se. Like,
yeah, he still tries to do right by his family and everything.
And he believes he's doing right in the world, which I think is a much more compelling way to play it
mm-hmm.
than if Dad is suddenly becoming this monster that you don't know. Like mm-hmm. it forces some of the characters to make moral decisions, not based on bad Dad's behavior, but on the actual things that Dad is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a great movie with a really super creepy premise. Thought he had a lot of, showed a lot of promise with Frailty. I don't think he ever made another movie that was as, I don't know. I he may have only directed the one other movie, but I was mm-hmm. always kind of hoping to see his career as a director sort of take off. Because Frailty seemed to be such a, cool. like, it seemed clear he had a vision.
He had talent for it.
He had a vision. Mm-hmm. He made exactly the kind of movie he wanted to make, and it was unique.
Yeah,
and I was
very unique.
We have a huge lack of that kind of that thing. And then the drill instructor in Edge of Tomorrow, the guy repeat or whatever. It's funny to see him, Hudson, and now he's kind of the like got it together, wrapped down tight drill instructor character. And there's a scene, I don't want to go too much into this, but where Tom Cruise keeps sort of dispatching himself every day in different ways, and mm-hmm. the faces on Paxton's face every time he gets run over by a truck. He's like, "What's wrong with you, boy?" As he's getting like his head run over by like a Jeep. Yeah, I mean, we could go on. That's a basic list, but the guy had a lot of stuff that he did, I think, that was really good.
Yeah.
He will be missed.
Absolutely.
I think that if you haven't seen Frailty, that's a movie to see. We'll be back when we can with a review of The Vagrant, because I think we need to see that.
Yes.
And interestingly, I heard Shout Factory is going to have a like Blu-ray release of it coming out this summer in May, so we'll be back before then with that. So let's move on to news. Chris, there's like news that you're like super excited about this week.
There's a bunch of stuff.
Well, there's one specific thing that you're just dying.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right, Nathan. There is something exciting coming tomorrow. And this is the 27th when we're doing this podcast. Tomorrow, the 28th, is a release date for a game that I've been waiting for like over a year to come out, ever since I knew of its existence. Horizon Zero Dawn. Super excited about it. I'm getting in the mail tomorrow. And you'll not probably see me for weeks, because I'll be busy playing this
game.
Fair
enough. Yeah,
This one, actually, you've seen a little bit about it. You've talked about it a little bit also on some podcasts, and I have as well. This thing looks amazing. It's just, you know, some dark future where machines of some sort have taken over the Earth, and humanity's hiding away in caves, some futuristic...
And these machines are now like animals. They sort of are wandering around in thousands of different varieties. And...
Yeah. It seems like every day I'm seeing a new image of some sort of creature I haven't seen before set in this game universe. So, like, it seems to be quite diverse.
And I read a pretty much spoiler-free review, and games, they're definitely at a point now where there can be spoiler reviews.
Oh, yeah.
That said that one of the cool things about this is we've had so many post-apocalyptic games. Last of Us comes to mind, but there are tons and tons of the Fallout, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But that the point here is that this is post-apocalyptic.
Way in the future.
This is essentially the same kind of thing I'm playing right now through Far Cry Primal, which is that you let me borrow, which is the Neanderthal kind of thing. That there's a lot of similarities, because you're back to a hunter-gatherer kind of tribe, but with this science fictional bent and not really knowing how the world got to where it is.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me, I read recently... A novel by China Melville called Rail Sea, which was sort of everyone's still in giant ramshackle trains that they built, and they're hunting giant mole rats as if they're whales. It's kind of like but the idea is the world's gone so far down a path that this new bizarre world is a certain sense of normal, but there's still a reason why it is the way it is. And that Horizon Zero Dawn looks like a lot of this game is you fighting these giant monsters. But in the review that I've read, it's like, it's cool because you have the weapons you need right from the beginning with your bow and your arrow and your hunter-gathering tools to fight them. But as you get more powerful monsters, as you encounter more dangerous foes, it's really about being able to diversify your weapons and
learning how to take them
down.
And
build, because these things are machines that are built out of parts. Once you've destroyed one, you can build new weapons out of it.
Yes.
So, you know, that appeals to the old school Mega Man fan in me, who gets the weapons from the, you know.
You can hijack some of them, like, and take them and use them for tools for yourself, like, to do things for you. It sounded like a very fascinating game. So.
Yeah, there are, to me, when I look at it, there are flashes back to that PS2 game, The Shadow of Colossus, which I was always a big fan of, where you had this small... humans kind of fighting these monstrous things, and there's this kind of story going on. So I'm excited to hear what you think about that too. I'm still trying to get through Far Cry, which I realize is probably several years old at this point. But
no, actually, last year.
Last year, yeah. Okay, cool. So I'm not too far behind the curve. I guess it is PS4. So yeah, Far Cry Primal is fun, but Horizon Zero Dawn looks awesome.
Yeah, it does. So I can't wait to play
that. I'm looking forward to having you come back and report on that. Again, this is probably going to be out in a couple days. So some of this news, maybe slightly old by the time you hear it, but last night we had the Oscars. And of course, movie that you and I absolutely love, we haven't really talked much about on this podcast, I think, but Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
The Denis Villeneuve science fiction movie, which
it's fantastic.
I thought was great, you know. And was nominated for a lot of awards, was right up there as a contender for awards, and it won. It won sound editing. And that
wow.
was it.
The thing is about that is about Arrival is there's so many great elements in the movie, and it's not like that there is a science fiction element to it, of course, but it's that's not to me ultimately the driving thing behind the movie. Like it's a lot more to it than that, and I don't think the Academy Awards really, the Oscars will ever like really care about anything sci-fi related. I don't know why, because there's
so
much
to break through.
So good on so many levels, and that's what they gave it. Sound design.
And it was nominated for many other things. It was nominated for Best Picture. Amy Adams was up for Best Actress. That's not to say that someone like Emma Stone was not deserving of her award for La La Land. I think she was. And, of course, we had that weird moment at the end of the night where they announced that the winners want La La Land, and it's really Moonlight. And I, when that happened, wait, that's not the winner. You know, there's a brief
Doesn't it
hope.
Seem like that's happening a lot more frequently now?
Yes. Like, seems like there's a brief hope. Well, they even had them up on stage like, accepting awards. You had that awkward moment where you had to take things back from people.
I heard Jimmy Kimmel jumped up on stage because he was the announcer all night.
He
was like, I blame this on Steve Harvey.
I will say that they handled it in a professional manner, and they kind of, you know... they took responsibility for it and dealt with it. But all that aside, to go back to the issue, which is that, sci-fi fantasy movies and horror films, for that matter, don't really get a lot of love with the Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's... They don't really have a problem. You're right. It ultimately doesn't matter. We're talking about awards. However, for the fact that we still put some kind of... And as a critic who, you know, at one point as being part of the film critics guild was involved in kind of this whole thing, it's not that they still obviously want people to, they'll nominate these movies so people have an interest in them. Last year Mad Max Fury Road and The Martian are both nominated for an award. They'll nominate the movie, they'll throw it out there to keep people interested, but I wonder how many of the times they really have an interest in awarding that film. It took Lord of the Rings. People remember that Lord of the Rings swept the Oscars for Return of the King, which is probably the least, maybe not the least, but it's not as good as the first movie in the series.
No, yeah.
As Fellowship of the Ring. It was essentially like we had to wear the Academy down after 3 years, where also, in addition, most of the live-action films just weren't that impressive that were competing. You know, the other live-action films that were competing with Lord of the Rings weren't all that impressive. So the only horror film I can think of that ever won the Oscar was... Silence of the Lambs in 91. And that, of course, is, you could make the case that that dovetails more into a thriller.
Exactly.
It's kind of a cursory level. It certainly has no supernatural elements. Mm-hmm. Other movies have been nominated, The Exorcist, but this is nothing new. It's nice to see these science fiction movies get nominated. I think this year, particularly for me, it's kind of irritating because Arrival, it is just simply my opinion, stood out of the pack of nominated movies as being a little bit of a cut above.
Yeah.
Personally, I wasn't that probably wowed by the other nominees.
To me, that was probably one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah. And I know some people aren't like head over heels for it, but I thought it was very good. I'm hoping that, you know, seeing Villeneuve tackle this, that this does mean good things for Blade Runner too.
Who knows? Yeah.
So we'll find out. But that was the Academy Awards. Nothing really that amazing to report. The coolest news of the...
No, this is legitimately amazing.
Yes, legitimately amazing is the NASA discovery of 7 planets that are essentially Earth-size. You're talking about planets that... and of those 7, 3 that could potentially have the capacity for life.
That's fascinating. That's amazing.
And it's funny, my son is now getting kind of interested in planets and everything. Mm-hmm. And he was asking me the other day when I was telling him there were new ones, and he said, well... which of these do dinosaurs still live on? And I hope that I can give him an answer. I can actually name one.
They said within 10 years they might be able to determine if there's like the kind of gases necessary on these planets.
For life. And of course,
life,
they're a little bit far away, but it's exciting. I mean, it's exciting in a time when I think in general terms, people are finding science and exploration less interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of...
There's still a lot of great, amazing discoveries out there.
It's neat to know that there's still some wonder to be had out there. And it, you know, it's something I personally like encourage my kids. So it's kind of neat to think that this this Trappist-1, which is a star, and which is
I laugh because that's like that was the coolest thing of it all to me, and on a lowbrow level, that the trapeze system or whatever. That's a great style of beer. Abbey ales. Like,
I'm thinking of monks, and you're thinking of beer that are made by monks. Trappist
that
ale.
That says a lot, I guess.
But it was just an ultra cool dwarf, which is...
Dwarves are always ultra cool. What are you talking about?
Seven Earth-sized planets, which Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted and said that he thinks they should be named after the seven dwarves.
I would be down with that.
I mean, there's
seven
of them. They are circling Trappist-1, so call them seven dwarves. You know what? People will remember.
Yep.
And we'll find out if it's sleepy or dopey or grumpy that have the planet. Has the life on it. So there's I will have a link in the show notes to some articles regarding that. And probably next week, we'll try to do a sci-fi episode where we kind of explore just the implications of more of that. Particularly, it's neat to think that for years, particularly science fiction authors have been exploring things like this. But what does it really mean when you're confronted with the potential of life on another planet? I think there's a lot. I mean, the very focal point of science fiction and science in general kind of.
Even on a microscopic level.
You're right. Like, we don't need to find dinosaurs or intelligent sentient life.
Mm-hmm.
You start with the building blocks
and
go forward. So we've had some neat teases about that over the past few years in different ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it's exciting.
Yeah, it's neat.
It's still exciting, particularly for someone who has watched the kind of, a little bit with a sad heart, as the space program just hasn't flourished. In recent years, mm-hmm. and we're definitely a different place than we were. I was reading my kids a really kind of fun book called The Dark Dark, which is talking about kind of, you know, this boy growing up being afraid of the dark, but he's also growing up right at the time that the moon landing happened. So it's written from perspective of an astronaut who does go on to grow up and become an actual astronaut who's been out to space and seeing the moon landing, and just kind of at a loss and a sadness that my kids, you know, that isn't as central a focus as it once was. You know, mm-hmm. we're not in the burgeoning days of the space program.
Yeah.
But this is still pretty cool news. So let's move on. Let's go to our mini reviews, and then we'll get into our feature review. Chris, you have a review for us this week?
Sure do. I went to go check out that movie by Jordan Peele, Get Out. That was quite an interesting experience. So this was not... as much on the sci-fi level as it is horror, but it's also a bit of a horror comedy to an extent. There's a young couple in the city going back to meet the young lady's family, and the young lady is a white girl, and the young man that she's with is an African-American man. And at a certain point, he's showing a little hesitation to going because he's like, does your family even know that I'm black? And that kind of shows a little bit of the underpinnings of this movie, where it's trying to, in a way, kind of show and showcase, expose some of the racism still prevalent in society, from just some of the more obvious and bigger issues down to like the more everyday stuff that even people who consider themselves progressive kind of on some level can still show that. So it goes from there. They go meet the family, and there's some, you know, ominous things happening along the way. And I can't say too much about it because I feel that probably most of the listeners of the podcast at this point have probably seen a trailer for it. Or have seen the film itself. So I don't want to spoil anything because the trailer does tend to give a good portion of the story. There's still a few twists and turns and surprises in the movie. But ultimately, it boils down to, you know, they go meet the parents, and there's that traditional, goofy meeting the parents kind of stuff, interactions. But at the same time, there's also a kind of a sinister undertone that something's just not right here when he meets, like, the help around the house. And
who also happened to be African-American.
Yeah. and so the he's the help seems to be kind of like silent and don't really want to talk too much or anything. So he's suspecting something kind of weird's going on there. And later on, the movie keeps going, and they're going to throw a big party at the house, and the daughter's all like, we should probably go. This is kind of lame, and my parents are kind of lame, and this whole thing. But you know, the guy wants to be there for her, shows he's a good man to her parents and everything. So they decide to stay. And that's when things start going kind of crazy, into crazy territory. If you've seen the trailer, you kind of know where this is going.
So, without no spoilers on what happens, but how crazy does this really get?
It goes out there. Let me tell you.
The question in my mind, and having seen the trailers, is it, and a lot of the reviews have referenced things as disparate as like the Stepford Wives and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which you both get.
Both of those things are accurate to say.
Yeah, like, you get that from the trailer, but it looks, my question is how much of this is comedy, which is what mm-hmm. I mostly know Jordan Peele for doing, mm-hmm. and how much of this is horror? And I think that's maybe the question. How is this a horror film with some comedic notes, or is this a comedy with some horrific notes?
To be honest with you, I think they were trying to go for like a comedic horror movie, but it never quite really gets there. Like, it's entertaining in what it does, but it's got a few creepy moments slowly peppering the beginning of the movie, mixed in with some of the more funny stuff. And then slowly it gets stronger as the movie goes along, till pure insanity towards the end, you know, of some, like, crazy horror stuff. But I feel like this, if you had to define it, I would say it was definitely more of a horror movie with some comedic elements. But it really was more 50-50 to me. I think they tried to blend it pretty equally.
I kind of like that. I even like that you are kind of galvanizing more towards horror than comedy, because that makes it a slightly different movie than I was perceiving. It seemed like,
yeah.
Now, how about, because this movie has up until a few days ago, it had almost 100%, I think it had 100% on mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes, and just in terms of the feedback of the critics, is that it was really good. Now, in your opinion, Chris, because sometimes the critics can get carried away, we find a good movie, and we're mm-hmm. so happy to find a good movie that's kind of fresh and inventive, that has something to say, that we have a tendency to maybe overpraise it a little bit. Do you think that's happening here with Get Out?
I think this feels, I mean, especially for the times, it feels relatively fresh and interesting. The main problem I had with it, as I was expecting it to go a little further in its, like, deconstruction of things, I felt that it was going to get a little more biting in its social satire. I think I was expecting a little deeper dive into that, because it's some of it is kind of on a surface level, what it's trying to say, and I thought it was going to go a different direction with it. But it's still a pretty good movie. I would recommend people be entertained by it, for sure. It's pretty yeah. good, but it wasn't, to me, the main problem that I had was between, obviously, that part, and the other part was that it wasn't super scary. Like, it was definitely a horror movie, but I was kind of anticipating certain things, and it didn't really freak me out that much, but maybe it's just because I've seen so many horror movies.
That's true. You know. And I have pretty sad reasons. But I think
people in the theater were getting freaked out at certain points.
I think it's a legit point, because I think over the years, some horror movies, even particularly the kind of fresh inventive ones, can mm-hmm. sort of be so hyped by the time we reach them. I know It Follows was a good horror movie, but by the time I came to it, it felt like a lot of the momentum of that film had been stolen away by people just proclaiming it.
That's the greatest, like a great
movie. I had seen The Witch earlier, so that mm-hmm. didn't happen to me. The Witch, but you see a movie like this. This is probably not accurate in the least. But when I see the trailers for Get Out and I see where it's going, the sort of satirical and relevant bits aside, does this have anything of a feel of like a You're Next to it? Because that's almost a movie that, just purely watching the trailer, I'm like, does it? It seems like You're Next is a movie that kind of takes a while to get going, and then eventually kind of just bolts out of the gate and just keeps running.
It does, but it doesn't have very far to go at that point. Like, it does go into Your Next territory, but by the time it gets there, there's not much left to do. So yeah. Like it's there is some of that, but it's not, the whole movie is not like that. It's,
now, were you surprised at all? I don't know how familiar you are with like Key and Peele, but were you, having seen Keanu, I am a little bit surprised that Jordan Peele maybe had this movie in him.
I actually don't really know much about him, but it was fairly, like, for the kind of stuff we're seeing today, like, fairly good, well-thought-out movie. Like, that same weekend, I'm almost ashamed to admit it, but I hey, what can I say? I love Ice Cube. I love Charlie Day. I saw that Fist Fight movie. That was an awful, awful, terrible comedy. I will admit I laughed a little bit here and there. But in comparison, if you're thinking like, well, these guys are not, they're going to make some kind of, since they're on Comedy Central, they're just going to make some lowbrow comedy or whatever. This was nothing like that. I was surprised. Like, it was pretty well thought out. I liked it a lot.
Well, I'm interested to see it. My wife is interested to see it. I have my sister almost convinced to see it, too.
And she doesn't like that kind of thing.
Not usually, but she saw the trailer. And I think, though, there's ideas behind it. And I think
there are a lot of ideas.
Seems to be what's catching.
If nothing else, this is a good conversation thing. Like, if you go see this with some people and you want to talk about some of these, like, social issues today... Like, I think this is a good way to start the conversation because it's entertaining. It's not really all that preachy. It gives you everyone's kind of perspectives. I think overall it's not trying to demonize one side or the other, but I think it's a good entertaining way to kind of talk about things.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it. And I think that can be one of the strengths of horror movies sometimes, that given the genre, they can kind of diffuse some things we wouldn't necessarily want to talk about or engage in. We talked about horror movies like The Invitation and stuff from last year, where it opens up a conversation piece about something that you might be uncomfortable discussing.
Yeah.
Otherwise. So absolutely. Now the movie I'm about to talk about is not, has no real redeeming value in terms
Save
of social
artistic.
or yes, which is, and it's a movie that is not getting great, great critical response or great accolades. Get Out was a big financial hit over the weekend. This movie really is not. It may be a movie that ultimately China ends up saving financially, much like Warcraft. But this is The Great Wall, a movie that's kind of like...
Wait a minute, isn't that the documentary about the Donald Trump thing?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's not. No, no, no.
Thankfully.
They actually build this wall.
Oh, okay.
And this is the movie...
Did it cost China billions of dollars? Sorry.
This is the movie... That from the very first trailer, I remember hearing, oh, there's a Great Wall movie. And, of course, the big whitewashing complaint comes back into play, which was happening kind of this time last year with Gods of Egypt, which is such a much more ridiculous example of that. And that movie itself was so horrible that, you know, it kind of came and it went. And Great Wall may have the same trajectory and fate. The interesting thing here is this is a Chinese joint production. So China's heavily involved with making this movie. The director... Zhang Yimou has made lots
Hero.
Of really good movies.
That
well, he, in his more like recent incarnations in the 2000 arena, like 2003 to 2006, he did a series of movies. He did Hero, like you said, with Jet Li. He did House of Flying Daggers. Mm-hmm. He also had Zhang Ziyi in it, and he also made. I think the third one, and that was The Curse of the Golden Flower, had Chow Yun-Fat in it. And that movie, those three movies, were very visual, very artistic movies that kind of fell back on a lot of like the Chinese theatrical imagery and art and things like that. And he's done movies much earlier than that, Raise the Red Lantern, dramas that are very well respected. So he's made a lot of these movies, and then his new movie is this sort of big, expensive action movie that has Chinese actors in it, has a Chinese setting completely, and then decides just to throw in the American, who he's not an American in the film, but the Caucasian hero who comes in and inserts himself in here. Yeah. And it's played by Matt Damon, which is honestly kind of the most distracting thing about this movie. Now, that aside, it's a movie about the Great Wall being invaded by an army of giant monsters, thousands and thousands of creatures that just swarm the walls. And so watching the trailers, you see Matt Damon with his like kind of mullety hair and his warrior garb, and it's not really working. You know, he's trying to affect almost a Celtic accent, which is weird because it's like
that's
it's
bizarre.
It's,
why
it's,
would you? Do
it's
that?
not unlike Kevin Costner trying to do his Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves kind of deal. And now that being said, we lay all that aside and you put it where it is. I went to the movie, and I legitimately had a good, fun time with this movie. This is a matinee.
It looks like just a popcorn film.
It is,
know?
But it's. I'd say it's actually a lot more entertaining. It's a lot more solid. It's a lot more consistent in its entertainment value than a lot of the fantasy movies we've had over recent years. I mean, we had that Huntsman Winter's War movie last year. It's kind of a dud. We've had, like I mentioned, Alex Proyas' Gods of Egypt. A lot of the big fan... I'd say this movie, to me, was more satisfying than Peter Jackson's Hobbit movies, you know?
Oh, wow.
From the, nice. The, I mean, well, well I guess I'm not going back really to Lord of the Rings. I'm talking specifically as Hobbit.
Yeah.
The point is, as far as a fantasy movie goes, this movie worked for me. It is not... It, first off, it clocks in about an hour and a half. It does what
solid,
it does.
Solid,
nice. Then it gets back out. Visually speaking, even though we have a lot of CGI, a lot of monsters in this, Yamal has a really nice sense of the visuals. And so as these creatures are gathering and pooling up at the gates, you have the various ways in which the Chinese army is trying to defend the wall itself. And one of the great scenes involves some of these kind of female warriors acting almost as acrobats who attach themselves to these giant hoops and then are on basically a bungee cord and will throw themselves off the sides of the building with their swords to cut at the monsters. And Yamal is the kind of guy who's going to take the time to show you them throwing hundreds of the bloody rings down to show that not everybody's coming back from this. So just like we've wiped out some monsters, Damon looks over and there's a big pile of the bloody gory rings. Wow. So as they pull them back up the wall. And the creatures look interesting. They have a whole mythology to them. There's a sort of casteism. So not every creature looks the same. You have your soldier
caste. Are they Mongolian creatures by any chance?
Are they Mongolian? The monsters themselves are based off of Chinese mythology. So they have
awesome.
The Tao Te do have a place in Chinese
fantasy,
but not in history. That's and they're cool. Kind of like giant locusts. It's interesting because it becomes very much a siege movie of the likes of Zulu or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it is... what's interesting is there's also elements of the Beowulf story here, particularly early on an arm is chopped off and it's evidence that the creature's been here. And there's a hard science fiction book called The Legacy of Harriet. Harriet being the hall that Hrothgar built in the Beowulf mm-hmm. legend. But this is a movie about a planet where a bunch of explorers sort of reenact the Beowulf story. And there's hordes and hordes of monsters who sort of are oncoming and there's an onslaught. But Yamal, again, focuses on the visuals with some really beautiful stuff. And it's interesting to watch them combat the monsters. There are scenes of these giant sort of almost hot air balloons that are like giant lanterns carrying rafts where the Chinese warriors are up on the rafts sort of dumping weaponry over to fight the monsters. And there's just a sea of these beasts. But there's a whole system where you have the warriors, you have the kind of bodyguards, you have the queen. So mm-hmm. the monsters themselves are slightly interesting in that there is something going on. They have a culture. They have a system.
Hmm.
They don't speak or anything like that. They're beasts. But there's enough there that there's an added kind of element of interest. And the movie flies by. I again, was taken in by the visuals. I had a fun time with the action. It reminded me of movies that are probably kind of guilty pleasures to me. Movies like The 13th Warrior with Antonio Banderas. Again, a take on Beowulf.
Yeah,
I don't think any of this is incidental. The 13th Warrior is its own Michael Crichton version of
that
Beowulf.
The Eaters of the Dead, I think.
It has a siege element to it when the Eaters of the Dead kind of come in at the end of that story. Mm-hmm. And that also has the foreigner to a different land kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that movie. It wasn't great. I think I like Great Wall a little better. On the other side, that Outlander with Jim Caviezel, which was, again, a Beowulf story. And that, if I were to put Great Wall, I'd say Great Wall sort of in the middle. Mm-hmm. And the monsters here aren't that unlike the Morwens in Outlander. So if you haven't seen any of those movies, I'd recommend all three. But Great Wall is a PG-13. The violence is mostly in the nature of monster violence. So if you're wondering, is it appropriate for kids in the range of, like, you know, the 8 to 10-year-old, mm-hmm. I think it could honestly handle the movie. There's not a lot thematically that's going to be too dark in there.
Well, and you
it's
did
a fun
mention
adventure movie.
A gory rings.
Well, I mean, the rings are there, but they're it's
implied
we're not
violence.
It's more implied. Again, yeah. It's a kind of thing where you look at it and you sort of know. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of monster jumping. But let me put it this way: if you have a child who's at the level to enjoy the Lord of the Rings movies, they can enjoy the Great Wall. There's nothing over the top there. So I enjoyed it. It was like kind of the perfect kind of matinee movie to me. And I was surprised because I really didn't expect to like it that much. So
that's cool. Yeah.
So now, Chris, that brings us to our feature review.
Logan, what did you do? Charles, the world is not the same as it was. Mutants. They're gone now.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Where is she?
Beneath the stains.
She's like you.
Of time.
Very much like you.
The feelings disappear.
She needs our help.
You are
someone to come along.
Someone has come along.
I am still right here. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down. I will make you hurt. I will keep myself. I would find. Away.
Logan, you still have time.
Yes.
The new Wolverine movie, which I wonder, should, like, to even call it a Wolverine movie, which puts it in the proximity of both Wolverine Origin and The Wolverine, which is directed by James Mangold, who also did this movie, might not be completely fair, because I think this is fairly different, not just than the Wolverine films. Mm-hmm. This is different as well from the X-Men movies.
Absolutely.
But it still has a certain element of continuity with those movies.
Yes.
This can still exist in that universe if you wanted to. It can also kind of stand alone.
Yeah, and I'm not even convinced that it is in the same universe, but it could, like you say, it could. This set in 2029, which, of course, Marvel every once in a while puts out a 2029 series of things that happen slightly in the future or a little more futuristic. The older in 2029s were way futuristic.
Right. Well, I was thinking 2029, even where the events of the X-Men movies has happened, you're right, it's almost too soon.
Yeah, in exactly. A sense. And if this is the 2029 set in the timeline or the universe of the other Marvel, X-Men movies, things have gone very badly for them, I'd say, at this point. It's pretty sad if that's
Wolverine's
how things
hash out. Wolverine's
had
a hard couple of years since Days of Future Past.
Yes, he has.
And actually Patrick Stewart, who returns as Professor X here.
I was concerned originally, one thing about this movie, I saw the trailers, so I was kind of excited for it. One thing I was concerned was, yes, it's rated R. Did Fox get the wrong lessons from the popularity of Deadpool? Like, you know what I mean? Like, because that was a rated R hero movie. Did Fox get the wrong lessons from that and make it just loaded up with crude language and dumb jokes and stuff just because that's clearly worked in the past? Or they're going to make like a legitimately good movie with some violence, with some language stuff in that is appropriate to the characters? Luckily, I found it to be the latter case, that this R actually really suits it. And the story itself is not real, is a pretty gritty story regardless of any of the content of it. So I think it really fit perfectly well. I think if I were to describe the other like Wolverine movies, I've never been a big fan of either. Like the second one, The Wolverine, I thought was a little better. But this one is a whole cut above that one to me because of the story they've got for it.
This movie definitely tries to stand on its own as a story.
Yeah.
Which I didn't find was the case with either of the other Wolverine movies.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, like you said, I enjoyed the first half of it. It had the Japanese setting. It seemed like it was trying to head into telling some of those Japanese set
mm-hmm.
Wolverine stories that were kind of classic. It had kept jumping directors. Darren Aronofsky was supposed to do it at one point. And now you had James Mangold directing it. But it became, in the second half of that movie, much like I thought the entirety of Wolverine Origins was, it became the PG-13 bridge to an X-Men movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was mostly superheroes throwing stuff
yep.
at each other and fighting, and you lost a sense of Wolverine as a character, to me, in both of those movies. Which is not the case mm-hmm. remotely at all.
This one, it's straight Wolverine as a character. A very different Wolverine than we've seen before, but it's all about his character. He doesn't get lost in this at all.
No, psychologically, it's in his headspace for the most part.
Yeah.
And it is based off of, to an extent, it's based off of a graphic novel.
Yeah, I think it's got some ties to, like, Old Man Logan. This isn't the universe of Old Man Logan.
There was a lot of Old Man Logan stuff that it had incorporated, like, Hillbilly Hawk families and stuff. Yes, that Hillbilly is not Hawks. The Hawk, because we've got the kind of rights infringement there. There was no Hawk.
There was really no comparison, honestly, to me to Old Man Logan. I originally, when I saw the trailers, I thought it would be.
The stories may not be linked. I think Old Man Logan is the kind of genesis or the starting point.
You know where it does match up, I think, is the headspace of Logan and Old Man Logan. Yeah. Which, since so much of the movie Logan is set up as, like, this is Logan's psyche right now, and we're all experiencing it.
In the same way that
it makes sense.
No one's really fully made, except for the anime movies, has fully made The Dark Knight Returns.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of, it's clear that The Dark Knight Returns has influenced a lot of, like, Batman lore. And so it seems to me that, like, Fox didn't have to go and make up this story about an old, embittered Wolverine. Here's what I think. The Old Man Logan, as a graphic novel, is a neo-Western story that puts Wolverine in the role of the gunslinger kind of character.
Yes.
And that's what, I guess what I'm trying to say, this is what this movie is. Tonally, it's a neo-Western.
Yes, tonally, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm. But I think that just like some of the Japanese storylines from the Wolverine comics were the basis for the Wolverine, that was not an adaptation of a single comic book story. Yeah. And I don't know what was happening in Origins. But the less said about it, the better. So,
Director.
Fox redeemed Deadpool from that movie, and now they've, in a sense, redeemed Wolverine here. But I'm almost content not even talking about this in a sense of it being a Wolverine movie. It's certainly, to me, I don't even think of it as being the third Wolverine movie.
It doesn't really feel like that. At the same time, though, it's cool because you never could go full Wolverine in the old other ones because they were limited, like PG-13, all this kind of stuff. What I mean by that is you never really got to experience the Wolverine rage that was always there in the comic books and it's to its full extent, like him going full Wolverine until late in this movie when that happens. Like, things like that.
Not even that late experience. Into this movie.
Well, fair enough, does, yeah.
It certainly gets more violent as it goes along, but it starts pretty violent.
You're right, yeah.
But, yeah, this is a hard, like, up front, this is a hard R-rated film.
Yes.
This is a very action-packed movie. We're sitting here talking about it like it's a character piece. It is, to an extent. But this is a pretty well-paced action movie.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, it lagged a little bit here or there
for me, the mid-sections.
But I would say that it ultimately doesn't discount much of the entertainment. It doesn't really hurt the film. There are just moments that it could have been a little bit more lively. This is a dark, downbeat story in some ways, but I wouldn't say it's nihilistic. It's an interesting, realistic take with these characters, but this isn't the Dark Knight in the sense where they're taking the action scenes and sort of scaling them back outside of the world of the comic. Some of the stuff that Wolverine does in this movie isn't that different than what he did in the other movies. It's just more intense.
Yeah.
He will still leap through the air and dig his claws into someone.
Yes.
The mutant aspect is still there. It's just that Mangold, as a director, I don't think that this is that close to the work he did in Wolverine. It's a lot closer to work he did on 310 to Yuma, like a Western film. And you can tell that...
I could see that comparison.
There are some very explicit... There's explicit violence in the film, but there's explicit references to Westerns. There's even a kind of cool scene where at one point, Professor Xavier and the young girl in this film, who I don't think it's really a spoiler to say, she has mutant powers that haven't been explored or seen before, and she comes into the orbit of both Logan and Xavier, who are in very different places in their life. I mean, Logan is dealing with a lot of things, both physically, emotionally, and psychologically, and so is Professor X. I mean, you've got him to the point where he's almost senile, and the question becomes, what happens to someone whose mind is a literal physical weapon when they can't control it anymore?
Yeah.
And they kind of explore that in an interesting way. Patrick Stewart gives a kind of almost understated performance here. Like, I thought, gives a performance that doesn't go as far as you might think, but is effective. Like, he doesn't have as many big moments, But it's poignant, I thought. I think he gives a lot of depth to the character. He gives more depth to the character in his frailty here than I think he did in the commanding moments of him being Professor Xavier in the other X-Men movies. He always kind of seemed like he's a figurehead. There was a lot more humanity, I thought, coming through here.
Yeah, I thought, honestly, this is probably the best version. I mean, it's the most depressing version, but I think the best version we've seen of Professor X being embodied by Patrick Stewart in the whole series. Like, I think this is the best he's done with it.
Which is, yeah, it's a good point because I think everyone got so excited when they hired Patrick Stewart for a couple different reasons. One is like, oh yeah, he looks like Professor X. The other is, we've got a legitimately gifted actor playing this guy. But I ask you this, in X-Men, in X2, and I get, you know, even X3 and then Days of Future Past, what did they do with that Professor X character that warranted Patrick Stewart being there? I mean, yes, he was commanding, but
not much.
He was exposition mostly. Yeah. He had no real meaty scenes. Here's a movie where you're like, that's why Professor X needs to be played by Patrick Stewart. And it's lots of subtle stuff. I said this about Green Room, where he played a character that itself wasn't subtle, but he played it in an effective, kind of straightforward way.
Yeah.
He does the same thing here. This could be a man struggling with his mind and it falling apart, and not in a showy, kind of flashy way.
Yeah.
How about Hugh Jackman? What'd you think about that?
I think it's one of the best time we've seen him as Wolverine. Like, he was really struggling with a lot of stuff, like emotional baggage over the years. I mean, when he talks to the little girl in the movie, he's like, you know, life is not guaranteed you. Like, I think that was some of the best.
He's pretty well ground down physically and mentally by the time we meet back up with him. And the little girl, fantastic little actress too. And some of the stuff she's called doing this movie, that must have been an interesting time on set with her parents. Now again, for anyone who's listening to this, this film, we're not getting into like sexual content of any kind. I mean, I think there might be a flash of brief nudity in the movie, not related to this character, but there's a great deal of violence. Don't be fooled that this is an extraordinarily violent film. But I think for the most part, fitting to what the movie is.
I watched John Wick 2 not too long ago, and I was like, that is an extremely brutal movie, and I think Logan beat it out for brutality.
There's probably one reason I thought this, which we'll get to at the end of this review, of why I maybe felt that movie was so brutal watching it. But Logan, I don't think the violence is necessarily out of place for the story they're telling.
It's perfectly...
And like I said, there is a scene where they're watching the old Western Shane on television, and Patrick Stewart is there. And
that was a great scene.
And that scene itself is not, you know, it's very intentional in its references and giving you a kind of pivot point for what the movie is about. Yes, this is a Western. There's some references to, you know, you get those kind of latter day movies like Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, but there's also, I think of a latter day John Wayne movie that isn't really all that well known, but I think one of his last movies was The Cowboys, one of his last Westerns. And Wayne is not even in that movie for the entirety of the movie, but if you know The Cowboys and you watch like some of the later scenes of Logan, there is a sort of dovetailing with that. So it's neat to see Mangold really using like what he knows about Western movies and kind of building it in there. But at the same time, retaining this is an X-Men, not an X-Men, but this is a story of mutants. This is showing the mutants where they are right now and what's going on with them and where Wolverine plays into all of that. For a guy who is in this movie series, has consistently felt like he's on the outside of being an accepted part even of the mutants, you know, he's been tampered with in such ways that even he doesn't even quite belong among the mutants. And the whole strain of the X-Men films has been Xavier trying to make him feel like he belongs.
Make him part of the family.
Yeah, it's interesting to see it happening more organically in Logan in very different ways, because there's no warm sunshine hugs or nice fuzzy speeches to be had in this movie. It's all pretty gritty and down to earth. I remember when when X-Men came out, or even before X-Men came out, everybody wanted an X-Men movie. And everybody had these ideas of who should play these characters. And for a long time, people, Sean Connery should be Professor X. And I'm not even sure if I can imagine that now. But for a long time, of course, the name on everybody's lips is, you know, Mel Gibson has to be Wolverine. I mean, it's hard to remember that now. But again, in the 90s, that was still like that had been a great thing. And honestly, one of the reasons that Hugh Jackman comes off so well in the original X-Men movie is, oh, here's another crazy Australian guy who, that 2000 is still well ahead of where we think Mel Gibson just lost his mind and became Max Rockatansky for real. Yes. I mean, this is still when, you know, so one of the things that Hugh Jackman going from, hey, this is almost kind of what it would be like to have the Mel Gibson of his 30s to play Wolverine.
That's fair.
I mention that because now Hugh Jackman seems to be kind of channeling the now run-down, broken, rugged Mel Gibson.
Very much so.
Like, there are scenes where you look at the piece, got the beard, you know, recently Gibson's had that kind of big, gnarly beard and that haunted look in his eyes. You're looking at him, and I'm not seeing as much Jackman as I'm seeing some of Mad Mel in his more recent years. Like, he seems to be channeling some of that, and it fits for where this character goes. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff. I don't want to get there. I think I get into spoiler territory if I talk too much more about some of the stuff that Jackman as an actor does in this movie.
Yeah.
But it's good. And I also, they bring in the character of Caliban, and I thought they did a really kind of cool job with that. Not doing exactly what you would expect. I don't feel like this movie does a lot of what
they've done
expect.
In the movie is what you'd expect.
Richard E. Grant has a kind of nice sort of character, the kind of scientist character that you typically see in these movies. Thought he did a nice job. Really, everything about the movie is handled with regards to how can we make this particular film good without any concern about what came before or what comes after. I don't know how to emphasize that anymore. This becomes a very meaty, red-blooded story because of that, and you're with it because of that. There's a moment when they go and they meet a family and they're on the road and they have this kind of dinner with them and everything. And everything involving that is almost like its own mini movie. And it's emotional. It's powerful. And it is almost one of the best. Logan is probably one of the best examples I've seen of taking a very dark, gritty. Again, let's not say they're even adapting Old Man Logan, but just taking the essence of a graphic novel, of a darker, gritty graphic novel about a popular character. And turning it into a film, this is about one of the best examples I've seen of that. Like, yeah, to me, I think Logan is more successful than V for Vendetta, more successful than The Watchmen. This is me personally, like, thinking that, like, they take what is, and movies like Road to Perdition, which, like, they take it and they distill it, and they don't lose the feel, the vibrance that comes with a graphic novel, but they don't trade it out for, like, silliness. You never sit there and you never feel silly for watching this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was excellent. Again, you know, it's really not something you can compare to the other X-Men movies because it's such a different beast.
Which is exactly why I like it. I mean, and you can't really compare it to the other Marvel movies.
Yeah.
I was not a huge fan, personally, of Deadpool. I get why people like it. I can see why it was refreshing in some ways. I thought Logan was a much more appropriate use of the rating they
Absolutely.
Had. Appropriate use of the cast. Just a good movie. Not the greatest movie you're ever going to see, but in terms of the Marvel movies, it's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
And it addresses a lot of the issues I've had with the more recent Marvel movies. It just feel like they're padding. It gets to exist outside of having to be a sequel to anything. It
or
gets
promote
to exist
anything
outside
else.
Of like, right, it doesn't need to set up the next Avengers movie or even a next X-Men movie. I think we had heard that there might have been credit sequences.
An end credit sequence, supposedly.
But you know what? Honestly, I really question that because, A, they didn't show it to us, but that sometimes doesn't happen. They'll screen a movie and doesn't have it. This movie absolutely does not need, require, or probably would want to have a credit scene.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, the final shots of this movie are almost so perfect in the way it tells a story that I don't even know what a credit sequence would do for us.
Nothing.
You know? Right. So, and I agree with that. So, if you're someone who likes Westerns, I think you can go see this movie just as much as someone who likes comic book movies. Just know, you're not taking the kid who wants to see the PG-13 Wolverine movie. Don't do that.
16, 17, a little older.
Yeah. Last thing I want to talk about.
A little more able to talk about context.
We had got to have a kind of interesting experience with the movie because we saw it as screening. Typically, sometimes these movies will be in 3D. They'll be in IMAX. They'll throw, you see in the movie.
You'll see in the most premier format they can show it to you or
something. They'll throw in some bells and whistles. They threw in bells and whistles this time. It was the theater we were at had a set of things called the D-Box, okay?
Yeah.
So this is like, this, when we looked at it, I was flashing back to, like, the Tim and Eric. They had the Schlang recliner or whatever, yes, where it would hook, like, hot butter popcorn up to your nose or something. And, you know, Jeff Goldblum is premiering it. Or should I say Chef Goldblum?
Yes.
But the... So this thing looks like that. It's like, it looks like an arcade system or something more than it does a seat that you sit in. And actually, I probably say it's, I guess the closest thing I can think of is the kind of thing you see at a Universal Studios.
That's exactly how I describe it.
Like a
it
sort
to
of
people.
Like vibration shock seat that moves around. Some, yeah. And seems
even
to
more
be,
intense than that, though, because like they had also behind it, like you say, the vibrations and stuff. It was almost like they had a bass right behind you, ready to blast you and like actually hit you in the back.
You're
like,
right, because this thing moves, but it's not set up to the movement of a ride. It seems to be. I haven't done any research to back this up. But in the experience we had, it seemed to be calibrated to the film's soundtrack. Not the music, but rather to the sounds and the effects and everything. So I could see this kind of being a lovely little thing if I'm watching, I don't know, a Terrence Malick movie and drifting through in the movie. Or Gravity and it's gently shaking as I kind of roll through space. And
I think you might get a spinal injury if you watch a Fast and the Furious film.
You could get a spinal injury watching this movie. So instead we have this for Logan. And they tell you up front, well, don't worry, turn the seat off if it bugs you, you know?
Yeah.
And Logan starts getting beaten in this film, almost from the
right away.
Like,
yeah,
we said this is a brutal movie, and he's a mutant, so and his ability is regeneration, so you know he's getting stabbed and poked and jabbed a lot. And honestly, I felt like I had been kicked about 20 minutes in.
You're shaking your around.
I noticed
like
I looked over and Chris had turned his off.
Yeah,
and it was just too much.
It was jarring. It took you out of the movie.
Not for this movie. There's a big chase scene, and I was feeling bombarded watching that. It was like getting the crap kicked out of you for about 2 hours.
I was surprised you kept it on that long. But
I don't know why.
There was one cool... I will give it this one thing. It had an interesting thing where the seats will move, actually directionally change, shift, and like up and down and to the side and all this kind of stuff as you're watching movies. So it was neat because as the camera in the film would like slowly turn, you would slowly turn with it. So that was kind of a neat
perspective. I think that may have been why I kept it on, because that element of it was a little interesting and I kind of wanted to keep seeing. Like,
in a gentler movie, I think it would be a much more entertaining
experience. There's a certain perspective shift of like it did nudge you along in the action scenes. I think I mostly kept it on just out of a determination to be like, okay, I'll
I survive.
I see this through to the end, but it wasn't pleasant. I can't imagine paying the extra money to do so.
No.
I think the length of a film, I don't really know what the use of this thing would be. I could see it being used for a 10 or 15 minute like experience. If you're at IMAX, you know, they do these 4D movies usually for kids where it's like for a 15 minute version of like the Polar Express. I could see that being cool for a kid.
Yeah.
I have no reason why you want to sit there and be beaten Logan in this movie. But outside of that, man, this is a good movie. I mean, I love that we are now in a place where March becomes the first summer month. Really.
Yes.
In terms of what we think of the summer movies, we've got some good stuff
coming up. Some neat stuff coming up.
And Logan's right there at the front of the pack. Comes out this Friday. I'm like a full go see it, full price.
Absolutely.
You can see it in a matinee, go for it.
I want to go see it again. So
I think it would be great probably in the IMAX format. They didn't screen it for us mercifully in 3D, so I appreciate that. Don't bother with the D-Box because you're just going to get beat up.
Unless that's your thing.
But it's... No.
No.
Moving along. So, great movie. We're going to finish up this episode with just a little something that I hope to do more of, which is kind of... You know, we talk about movies that are available at the theaters and things like that, and that's all great, but a lot of times you can't always get out to the theater to see a movie. And I want to do a little bit more of talking about movies that are available streaming, streaming-wise. There's awesome streaming options, particularly like Netflix seems to really be tearing it up lately. So we just watched a movie the other night, not together actually, but we were watching it spatially at the same time. My wife and I watched it here, and you watched it at your place. A Netflix movie that just came out Friday this past Friday, called I Don't Feel a Home in This World Anymore, which is a sentiment that runs through my head from time to time.
Yes.
And I think somebody said it sounds like it would be a Cure song from the 80s. You could almost imagine or Depeche Mode or somebody singing this song. And I'm like, yeah, I can hear that in my head. I think Jen actually thought it was a song, and as far as I know, it is not. But this is the latest movie from Macon Blair, who up to this point has been a writer. He wrote Jeremy Saulnier's Blue Ruin and Green Room, two movies that we've definitely talked about on this podcast before. Two very good movies. Two movies that could be characterized as horror films, but not exclusively. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this movie is a horror movie. However, it is a dark comedy in the vein, I'd say, of some of the more violent Coen brothers. Sort of.
Yes.
Has a little bit of Raising Arizona, some Fargo. has that kind of feel to it.
Yes.
But it has two really great performances from Melanie Lynskey and from Elijah Wood. Two very weird, quirky performances in a movie that is never as quirky as it might, as you keep thinking it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like it kind of keeps back just a little bit from jumping full like mode, absurd. Yeah. But it basically deals with a woman who comes home one day and her house has been broken into, and there's that sense of violation. Someone has stolen her grandmother's silver, and they've taken her laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts kind of pulling the people in her neighborhood to find out, well, who did this? And there's also a sense of just, she's kind of upset about the lack of human civility that seems to be in the world anymore. I mean, she puts a sign for people not to crap on the yard. Not people, but the dogs to crap on the yard. And someone comes along and does this. But this character who does this kind of ends up being almost her sidekick through the rest of the movie. She eventually, the phone goes off, and it has pinpointed where her laptop is. And she tries to get the police involved, but nobody has the time.
They won't touch it with
they're
a
not, portable yeah, pool, yeah. It's just irrelevant. It's this kind of thing like, you know what? This has happened.
I'm just going to go do it myself.
We had somebody recently near us, a neighbor, who saw people stealing stuff right off of her front stoop.
Wow.
And they were driving back to their house that was literally in visual distance of where she lives. So it's like, but how long, you know, these sorts of things, they tend to just go under the radar.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening here. So she doesn't know where to go, so she goes looking for backup, and she finds the Elijah Wood character who lives nearby, and she knows him through his brief interaction where she wanted to find out, you know, well, have you seen anything? So he's more than willing to come along, though. He has that... You described him as... What was it?
I described him as, like, a grown-up Napoleon Dynamite who's grown up in a trailer park. He's, like, kind of got... He is still sort of obsessed with, like, weapons and being awesome and, like...
He has nunchuckas,
yes. You know, fantasy things.
And morning stars.
Yes. And like, talking about being a warrior and stuff like that all the while. he's, like, also kind of nerdy, you know, and very quirky personality. I thought he was pretty great as that character.
He's good sidekick. He's almost sociopathic. They give him a lot of weird quirks. One of the weird quirks I thought was this faith element that they don't go overboard with, but he's very much into church and things like that, and even though he's really ready to be into, he seems to be ready to be in a scenario where he might kill somebody, still at the same time
does not bother him one bit,
but he balks at the potential that he might be caught, perceived to be stealing something, you know.
Yeah.
He has this moral code that's kind of weird and interesting,
skewed a little bit,
and but yeah, he grabs stuff and he shows up when they go to find the laptop, and the movie just spirals from there.
Mm-hmm.
And much like a Coen
Brothers
movie,
spirals.
These characters can't imagine where they're going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
When they go down this road, and Macon Blair does an awesome job, I think, of just keeping it surprising for us too. Like,
yeah.
Even when I
had
think
no
I know
idea
where it's going,
where it was
going
to go, yeah.
Even when I think I know where it's going, it goes somewhere else. And there's a weird altercation they have with an old man in front of this sort of like, I don't know, or in a pawn shop.
It's like
kind
a
of
pawn
scenario.
Shop slash chop shop or something.
Everything
I don't
that
know.
Happens in the scene is just, it's bewildering, kind of.
Yeah.
And it ends on a note of like, what? But the Elijah Wood has played a lot of strange characters lately. I kind of appreciate that he kind
I think
of
this is
has
his
gone
best
off
strange.
The mainstream. Yeah, he's done some weird stuff. He did Everything is Illuminated. He's been some creepy, scary characters too in movies like Sin City and Maniac and a particularly weird character in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a sinister in a low-key sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
It's neat work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a surprising movie all the way to the very last scene.
Yeah.
It's pretty violent, too. And Jane Levy has a weird kind of character that came out of nowhere. I didn't realize she's in the movie. and she shows up. And it's just that kind of a movie. It's a movie that is surprising in the moment. You can really kind of get into it and enjoy it. But at the same time, it does capture to me that kind of world weariness that just comes with wondering why we can't be better people towards one another. Exactly, and I think it does it in a better way than some of these other movies we've seen that have tried to address the same thing. You and I mentioned Bobcat Goldthwait's God Bless America. Mm-hmm. And
this one, I think, actually hits the point that that movie was trying to achieve.
Yes, and in a different way. We mentioned that. You also mentioned, we had talked about another movie, too, that I'm trying to remember, that dealt with that same kind of thing, the idea of someone struggling with the fact that people just aren't, you know, that we live in a world
we don't respect one
that
another.
Doesn't have civility, and it seems to be losing it by the hour. And in some ways, we feel like we're just constantly pitted against ourselves. You know,
I don't remember what that one was that we were talking
and,
about.
But this is pretty solid. I think that this is another good case for why I like what Netflix is doing. Did Netflix make this movie? No, Macon Blair has made the film, but gets distributed through Netflix. And they don't seem to be moving away from this model. So they're giving you...
Mm-hmm.
It was a really cool treat to be able to kind of turn on Netflix on Friday night or Saturday night, and just, hey, here's a brand new movie that would have been well worth your $11.50 or your $10.50.
Yeah,
if you had paid full price at a movie theater to see this movie, I don't think if you're the audience that this movie's looking for, you would not be disappointed. I think that like it's neat. Macon Blair did a great job with Green Room and Blue Ruin. It's nice to see him be able to take that voice and show he can direct just as well.
Yeah,
I think this movie is in the same ballpark as those movies.
Absolutely.
So not quite a horror film, but I think if you the dark kind of sensibility that comes with a horror movie, I think you can step out and watch this
hit
one.
Some it's of those good. Marks.
Yeah. So all right, everyone, that's basically it for tonight. We will be back soon with another episode of Phantom Galaxy. Chris, you're going to be out next week on a much deserved vacation. So enjoy, man. And you'll have to get back and listen to how Horizon Zero Dawn is. Otherwise, everyone, good night. Take care.
See you guys.